This
was a post by Rabbi Norman Cohen, who's Rabbi Emeritus at Bet Shalom, and I just thought this was a really nice reflection and brings us through this past week and this Christmastide season. So I want to read it to you all. When I went to Holy Cross College in the fall of 1968, I first saw a Catholic calendar, the equivalent of the ones Jews get from the Jewish funeral home each Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. I perused the Crusader calendar and noticed that January 1st was called the Feast of Circumcision. Then I counted December 25th, 26th, 27th to January 1st using all my fingers and no thumbs, eight. Since Jesus was a nice Jewish boy, that would be the day of his bris, or the day of his circumcision, his dedication, his entry into the covenant. When we consider the festive mood along with the toasting to a better year, especially this coming one, the ambiance of the celebration does resemble that of a bris. Although many scholars believe that December 25th is an arbitrary date for Jesus' birth, perhaps the 25th was intentionally chosen as the date for Christmas to link it to the 25th of the Hebrew month of Kislev, the annual date for the beginning of Hanukkah. That is when Jews celebrate the preservation of the Jewish people, whose existence was seriously threatened at the time of King Antiochus IV. Thus, the story of Hanukkah made possible the continuity of the Jewish community into which Jesus was born approximately 165 years later, and consequently, the observance of Christmas. Therefore, not only do the 8 days between December 25th and January 1st lead to the Feast of the Circumcision, but they also confirm the Christian tradition of the 8 days of Christmas, rivaling the tradition of the 12 days. Paralleling Christmas to our 8-day festival of Hanukkah in a very different way than calling Hanukkah the Jewish Christmas, which I love because that I know Jews hate that. This is not Jewish Christmas. They are very different holidays in their meaning and significance to our particular traditions, but perhaps they are connected in a variety of ways that we may never have imagined. Rabbi Cohen, I appreciated that. That was lovely. And in that, you know, spirit of our mutual traditions, we are going to have our first baby dedication virtually next Sunday. So Pacey Renshin is going to be dedicated next Sunday. We'll do that virtually. And I know there's some other new infants who have been born since the pandemic. And if you're interested in doing a virtual dedication, I'd love to set up a date with you all. And we can also certainly wait until we're back in person. So that's kind of up to everyone involved and what they're going to prefer. But next week, excited to dedicate Pacey. So, 10th day of Christmas, January 1st, Feast of Circumcision. I didn't know that. I know we celebrated in there, but you know, that's in some ways is a strange feast day, and in other ways is a great continuity. So I love Rabbi Cohen kind of bringing this to our attention during this week. We are going to continue in our series in 1 Peter. And as we kind of have several New Years, right? Advent begins the Christian New Year, and then we have this like secular New Year on the first. But we kind of, it's a natural reset time in thinking about the year ahead. And so I just want to give you a little picture of the next month coming up. We're going to do three more Sundays, finishing up in 1 Peter. Then on Sunday, January 24th, and Sunday the 31st, we're actually going to take those Sundays off. So we're going to finish up 1 Peter the 17th. We're just going to shut down the virtual world for 2 weeks, Sunday-wise. And then we'll kick back up together in February. So that, you know, as an elder team, we were kind of looking at this past year, and I was really realizing the last Sunday I wasn't on was the last Sunday in December last year, and Leah Everson preached that Sunday, and it was a remarkable message, and loved listening to that online. But, you know, our family was gone, and since then, it was like our January series of Epiphany, and we were getting as a congregation ready for the community development initiative with the city, when we're, you know, the whole neighborhood was going to come together for 5 sessions, and we had 2 of them, and, you know, kind of like started that uproar, and then it all shut down for the pandemic, and we stopped meeting in person and had to figure out how to do church online. And here we've been ever since, you know, since March to till today. And I've realized, like, there's been a few Sundays where I haven't preached in the last year, but there hasn't been a Sunday where I haven't managed it. And before our next kind of leg as a church together, I just need to shut my brain down on doing the logistics of online services so we can continue to be able to share life together. So that's what's coming up next week. Pacey's dedication. We've got 3 more Sundays in 1 Peter. Then we're just going to take 2 weeks off of online church and then come back in February. So that's where we're headed, if that's good with you all. So now for this morning, this is a really fascinating passage. And in kind of reflecting on it, there's kind of maybe 2 pieces here that stand out to me, then that link together. And for me personally, it really kind of speaks some new life into what engaging and joining Christ in life looks like, and what it means, and the difference that it makes. And so I'm excited to engage this passage with you this morning. But before I read this section again, I just invite us to pause, take in a deep breath. Kind of let that release out slowly. Breathe in the Spirit of God. Breathe out. Do you invite the triune God into your life this morning, into your mind, into your heart? Feel the Spirit in the breath as you let that out. What are you anxious about this morning? Would you release that to God's care? And join me in this passage. 1 Peter 4, read the first four verses. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the same in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. As a result, they do not live the rest of their earthly lives for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They are surprised that you do not join them in their reckless, wild living, and they heap abuse on you. Okay, so I want to sit with just this first section, and then we'll continue. And there's two other passages that I want us to reflect on as we look at that, at this. And just an aside, I'm going to assume, just in case you're wondering how the NIV works. So this is the 2011 NIV, so it's updated from the 1984. So what you experienced this morning, Tara, I think you, I'm going to assume that was the 1984 NIV, and this is the 2011. So if you're struggling with dissipation or whatever that doesn't exist here, and if you don't all like just like the man language, which I think is okay for that to go, that's slightly updated here as well. So evil human desires rather than just evil men, but evil men works too, I guess. All right, that was an aside. I want us to look at this beginning. Since Christ suffered in the body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. That's a really fascinating verse. It reminds me of Romans 6. There's this, like a similar theme, and then I'm going to read from Hebrews 2. So I'm going to join these like kind of famous ideas together. For if we have been united with Christ in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. For we know that our old self was crucified with him so that the body ruled by sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. Because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. So there's that same theme. Peter says, whoever suffered in the body is done away with sin. Paul in Romans says, because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. So Paul talks a lot about sin as a slaving power. And, you know, that's like kind of one school of like, slave kind of causes death and this slave cycle this way. Eastern Orthodox people kind of has like death causes people to sin, and it goes that the death is like the enslaving power, and more goes with like the Hebrew school, which is in Hebrews 2. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Okay, so those are three passages that I just wanted to get out on the table. And just to continue with my aside, Tara here, yes, read from my 8th grade confirmation Bible, and that is awesome. I say, you know, the best translation is the one you're using. So there you go. Okay, so there's this, those who suffer in the body are done away with sin. Those who die are, you know, have put sin to death, right? And then you have Christ breaking the power of the one who holds the power of death, who holds people in slavery to their fear of death. Okay, so this is the like the first kind of aspect that I want us to look at this morning. The slide here that I have is just like this sin-death spiral or a death-sin cycle. Petition. I love that. I'm not sure who's writing, but that NRSV, that is a good tradition, good translation. So yeah, if you want to do a change.org petition, I'm happy for us to consider that. But in both of these scenarios, kind of the Hebrew scenario and the Roman scenario and maybe Peter, there's this sense of life that's being controlled or enslaved by a power over. So I find this helpful in thinking about trying not to do individual sins, but that these passages are trying to speak about something deeper, about breaking kind of the power or the motivations that drive the actions that we do. Enslaving forces. That's actually a power that can be broken. And then there's this linking about like kind of putting it to death. Like you can kind of be done with that is the language that I'm hearing in these passages. And what I see in these scriptures, because anyone who has died has been set free from sin, or because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin, and the Hebrews, like Christ kind of frees us from the fear of death, it's like taking the death motive out of the equation then kind of frees us up to live a different kind of life. Live by the Spirit instead of by these enslaving powers. I want us just to pause here and kind of think of, I don't know, let this stir in you. What questions does this raise? What do you wonder about when you hear these verses, because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. What does that mean to you? How do you sense the Spirit stirring you about this? And then Peter's, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. What does this bring to mind for you? And if you have anything, you can post that in the chat. And as you're thinking about that, I just want to read kind of more of the Romans and the Peter passage just in this continued context. Now, if we died with Christ, we believe that we will also live with him. For we know that since Christ was raised from the dead, he cannot die again. Death no longer has mastery over him. So you like can't scare Jesus by death, right? I've gone through that. The death he died to sin once for all, but the life he lives to God. In the same way, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body so that you obey its desires. Do not offer any part of yourself to sin as an instrument of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and offer every part of yourself to him as an instrument of righteousness. So there's like a dying and a rising. A dying and a rising. And an identifying with Christ. It's like, oh, death can't hold Christ. It doesn't need to hold me either. Let's go to the... Next, let me read this passage in 1 Peter again. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourself also with the same attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. As a result, they do not live the rest of their earthly lives for evil human desires. So, like, to me, this beginning part, when I like read Romans and read this, there's like, you can die up front or do your suffering up front, so the rest of your life you can actually live it. You're not enslaved by these other powers and forces and motivations and desires, but rather for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do. And then, you know, here's the Peter's vice list: debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They are surprised that you do not join them in their reckless, wild living, and they heap abuse on you. Now, this last line, they are surprised that you do not join them in their reckless, wild living, and they heap abuse on you. You know, I'm imagining that many of you experience this differently. And it reminds me of a phrase that Brian McLaren introduced us to a few years ago in the Convergence Leadership Project. That is the conflict of multiple belongings. And to say, like, okay, 2,000 years ago, what was going on, right? So you had a whole way of living in Asia Minor. You had these Gentiles who became converts to really this new Jewish expression of the kingdom of God. And so you left one way and one community to join a different tribe, really. And it wasn't a community that had a lot of standing. In fact, it was one that was really scorned. So you know, imagine the normal holiday celebrations, going to pagan temples at certain times of year to do those rites and those rituals, and you're not doing them anymore. Like, your family, probably your extended family, you'd heap abuse on you. There would be a conflict between those identities. What I find is, like, you know, maybe more interesting now, or at least from knowing you all and your stories, a lot of the abuse tends to come from your former, like, Christian identities. So your old kind of tribal Christianity didn't work anymore, and you needed to evolve and leave that. But you still, you know, you've got a tradition there and you've got family there, and you experience this more of, like, people are concerned for your salvation or are praying for you because they think you abandoned the faith, or, you know, you can put in whatever story, but there's a conflict there. Because you have belongings in these multiple spaces. And a lot of the expectations and the loyalty tests that went with your formal tribe, you know, don't work anymore. And that causes existential anxiety on the part of those maybe who were a part of your former way of life. So I find this interesting. I don't, you know, there could still be, like, the old story of, you know, you had a life just of, like, reckless, abandoned, and then, you know, Christ saved you from orgies. But I sense most of that story is not your experience of how you've traveled and what Christ is doing in your life now. But yet, I think you can understand the suffering of this conflict of multiple belongings and the expectations of those who still, you know, relate to you in life. And so I wonder, even in this aspect, what that, how that suffering can free you into life in the Spirit. Because I think that's really what the invitation is here for, is to actually experience that suffering reframed in light of Christ's death and resurrection. And maybe for me, I can see like the power over me to appease those former voices. Like that's a death. Like I've got to have to die to that in order to then like be fully able to live into this new season that Christ is leading me into. That's one way that I hear this passage relate to me. Pause here. This is exactly my dilemma, and I'm so thankful for this place to not feel like I'm crazy for having legitimate questions, but also not wanting to throw my Christianity out the window. Yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate you, you know, voicing that dilemma in that way. 'Cause it's real, and it is painful, and it is a kind of suffering. And so if there's more of you want to comment kind of on that scene, we can pause. But I'll just continue with the rest of this passage that we're going to do today, because it links some things for me. 1 Peter 4:5-6. But they will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So for those conflict of multiple belongings and the abuse that you're feeling, there's kind of this sense of Peter will say later in this chapter, entrust yourself to God and to God's kind of justice. But they will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was preached, even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to human standards in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the Spirit. Now, this is another like crazy little verse in 1 Peter, and I love it. And for me, in going through this letter, there's like both like kind of these jewels and gems that you don't really see much other place in the New Testament. Then you kind of have that middle section that is deeply disturbing in kind of the one-off and what Peter's instructing for slaves and women, that's like, I think that's a problem. And then there's like these gems. And I kind of feel like it's kind of like our life. Like we've got these like beautiful gifts, and we also have like these entrenched patterns of thought that we're probably not aware that we're operating out of, that need to be like called out and held accountable. Like we've got to discern all of those things. And it's been an invitation for me into like this deep conversation with Spirit, to bring this biblical tradition in conversation with the triune God, and but to let the one who's ready to judge the living and the dead, and texts that are living and dead, and what we need to take with us and what we need to say no to. That's kind of like this whole other side conversation as we go through this book. But there's like, there's these gems, and then there's like this, like, oh man, that's awful. So That's kind of how I operate with First Peter. Is it's like this gift to be able to have this conversation with a tradition, and then see how the living Christ is speaking to us today. Okay, so I've switched the Orthodox icons. So I still had the nativity icon from last week with the temptation of Joseph, which was in the corner, which I just have to say, like when I go back to that image, so you see Joseph being tempted by the wise old man at the bottom is this depiction of Satan. That is my favorite depiction of Satan ever. So just in case you're wondering, that's it for me. Now this other icon, this is called the Harrowing of Hell. So this is the icon in Eastern Orthodox iconography of basically the Saturday before the resurrection. So Jesus crucified on Friday, and on Saturday he descends to hell. He grabs the keys that bind the dead, and he speaks the gospel. And so kind of the dude in green coming out of the coffin is Adam, and Eve is the woman in red coming out of that tomb. Like, so it's like these tombs are released, and Jesus is speaking the gospel to those who have died. This is one of the passages that kind of animate that tradition, the harrowing of hell. And it kind of, I don't know, this opens up some things for me to imagine and think about some things differently, and also like convict some of the ways that my faith has really operated out of like kind of a fear of death rather than being animated by the resurrected spirit of life. So here are some of the bullet points that I want to talk about. But they will have to give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead, for this is the reason the gospel was preached even to those who are now dead, so that they might be judged according to human standards in regard to the body, but live according to God in regard to the spirit. And this is just, it's a fascinating passage, right? So here are like some of the larger takeaways for me that I want to share about. The first is that God does not answer to death. So the divine is not limited by death's timeline. You know, that's one of the things that just kind of like opens up the imagination about. So our life a lot of times is measured by when we were born and when we die. And so death is an ending. But in this passage, it's like, their death was not an ending, which kind of leads to the next thing. So when we think of like death as a slave master, God is not enslaved by death. So that is like a lower order power. God's beyond that. The gospel is not under the power of death. So that's another. It is not hindered or stopped by death. So it's just like, just let this kind of expand your horizons of just this scene of Jesus preaching to dead people. I don't, like, it's kind of, it's like bizarre, but if I don't like try to map this out cosmologically, that's not how I'm like seeing it. Just like opens like the expanse that death is not the definer of all reality. And the good news is not hindered or stopped by death. So at least in Peter's imagination, right? It's like Christ wants to give everyone the opportunity to live according to God in regard to their spirit. So, you know, I think of justice that's not hindered or stopped by death. So there's kind of a sense of like, man, they got away with murder and then they died. They'd never have to give an account. In like this kind of imagination, it's like, no, everyone's going to have to give an account for what they did in the body. But there's also this ability to live according to the spirit. Now, and this is the other, the linkage here, is if you're done with sin when you die, then those who have died are kind of like no longer under its power. And if death is kind of this enslaving power that causes you to do awful things, it's like after you're dead, is there really kind of a release or a freedom to see your life and the world in a completely new light? Just kind of like, I'm just imagining that, you know, there's still like a consciousness after you die, so that there's just a different expanse here. And I'm almost envisioning this, just play with me here. You know, just imagine like someone on their deathbed that suddenly wants to like be reconciled with like their kids that they've been estranged to. And then like all of a sudden in light of their like that dying, it's like those grudges are meaningless. And why did we fight about that? And why there's kind of like this release. It's like I no longer have to hold that on. And so instead of like death being this ending, it's almost like this release under a power that expands the ability now live in the spirit for God. I don't know. So according to Peter, he's got this kind of after-death imagination that the gospel in God is not limited by this linear timeline that we kind of set ourselves to. Okay. Imagine religion that is not motivated by death. So I think about that in my own tribe that I grew up in, and when I evaluated and discerned, a lot of its formation was motivated by a fear of death. So I'm afraid to die. Well, you can go to heaven. So the gospel was posed really by this motivation of like a fear. And then even like evangelism was motivated by this fear of death. People are going to die and go to hell. And so a lot of this death motivation like was this urgency to do a whole lot of like activity in the world. But it's like the animating spirit of that was really this fear of death. And I also realized like kind of in my own formation how codependent that was. Like it was the focus was so much on everybody else's status, where they were in terms of God, and less on like my own, like, am I putting to death like those fears and living by the Spirit? Or as Jesus would say, take the log out of your own eye, then you'll actually be able to see clearly what's going on in the world. And I saw a lot of this was really kind of reversed formationally. And why it was reversed formationally was because the animating spirit was of a fear of death. And so I'm like imagining a faith tradition not motivated by death. So it's like if that fear is kind of removed and released, then like the operating posture is really not, there's like a life-giving animation to life and love. And I also like just kind of the scarce fear drivers aren't there. There really is a gracious posture in the way that you relate to yourself and others. It's not so like anxious. So I think even maybe some of you are experiencing the anxiety of a faith tradition the tribe that you kind of are trying to like move out of is on you, because really what's animating that is death. And so like everyone's afraid for you. Really it keeps them from it's an inability to discern what's actually happening, because you're actually just fine and you're actually moving into more life, and need to continue to do that. And then this final observation for me is, imagine your life not motivated by death. You know, if death was not a motivator and all of its odd manifestations, what would that look like? And for me, this has become my definition of like living by faith. I embrace this by faith. So today, David, what does living out of the spirit of life, not out of a fear of death, look like today? And living that out, me, is life of faith. So I'd say like a summary here is, Christ frees us from the power of death so we can truly live. That could be like, for me, one manifestation of what the gospel is. Christ frees us from the power of death so we can truly live. So even in this First Peter passage, Christ in the harrowing of hell is preaching the gospel. Like, you're free from death now. Now you can actually like truly live. I don't know, how does that animate you? How does that stir in you? What does this do for you? I'll pause. A few comments. Jack once said, what if people created God to force people to be good? This idea that if we took away the fear of death absolutely changes what faith and religion looks like. I love that potential. That's a really insightful question by your son. I think kind of imperial religion is just that, is to have like the authority over you that's there to control. And you see Christ bringing this very different. The spirit is like the wind. It goes, no one knows how it comes, where it goes. And that is a good, good comment there. Thank you. All right. This next, I just want us to explore kind of this living by faith. Or what if we lived in which death wasn't, you know, over us, controlling us, is to reflect on how death power manifests itself for you. A wonderful book on this is by Richard Beck, called The Slavery of Death. Richard Beck, Slavery of Death, if you're interested in kind of like exploring this more. Of just like the different ways of how death anxiety gets worked out in real life. So sometimes this manifests itself as like a self-esteem project. Like, is my life worth enough? Or even like a focus on legacy. We see that as like a really good thing, or like being a hero. But a lot of this is underneath, there might be this like motivation, because I'm going to die. You know, you have bucket lists and all kinds of other things, which like some of these in and of themselves might not be like debilitating. But I just want us to like imagine, how much does death kind of undergird and motivate how we approach things? Our approval by others. Is that a form of like death anxiety? Or am I enough? Am I good enough? Am I spiritual enough? Am I successful enough? Am I talented enough? You can see greed as a manifestation of like the fear of death. I need more and more and more. Or hoarding. These are kind of greed and hoarding are manifestations of like there's only so much. Scarcity is rooted in like a death anxiety. There's not going to be enough. Sometimes just like the weight of kind of a world motivated by death, you know, leads to all kinds of despair and like self-medicating behaviors. So it's like they're not necessarily bringing life, they're just trying to dull the pain of like the reality of all the death around us. Losing a job, losing a family member, losing a friendship, losing these forms of loss can be animated by a kind of death anxiety, just a feeling of dread. So all of this is just kind of like reflecting, and I feel like this can be a self-reflective exercise and time of prayer for spirit just to reveal, you know, how is the power of death manifesting itself in me? Because that kind of motivation and that kind of power over, you know, in the biblical imagination, it leads to like sin behaviors, not loving, life-giving behaviors. So motivated by life-giving spirit versus motivated by scarcity, approval, not losing, being successful. You know, all those kind of things will look different for all of us. And I want to kind of close with this prayer. I'll share a few of your comments here. I relate to this question about how Christ frees us from the power of death so that we can truly live. From being part of an evangelizing ministry for so many years, although fear of death wasn't a leading topic as we shared, it did sort of hang in the air as we considered sharing our faith in nations whose national faith was other than Christianity, meaning our emotional senses were capitalized on out of the fear of where these folks would go after they die if we didn't go and tell them. And this cuts off for me, Donette, so you might have finished this thought. This energy of putting, like, we are responsible for everyone's eternal state is a bit heaping on, and I think more than what Christ actually is at, is not our work, in a sense. So that's been like a shift in me, like and almost like a, it's taken a long time in my life for like evangelism to be redemptive, and I feel like that's becoming more in that evangelism is a witness really of a life freed from the power of death so you can truly live. And it's like, I want more of that goodness in me. And there's kind of an allowing for that gift to be shared. And also a seeing how we can be like almost tour guides for how Christ is already at work in people. But that that I know that was a huge burden that I carried. Like, I was responsible for the world's eternal salvation, is something that I think is undone a little bit in this 1 Peter 4 passage, where it was like, no, actually, like, Christ was doing that work, and death wasn't the, like, ending or the motivator why we need to, like, gallivant around the world. And so I think if we have a little more grace and perspective on, like, our own life, and it's not, like, codependent with the whole rest of the world, it actually frees more loving action and life-giving action into the world. So thank you for that, Donette. Rachel says, it's also interesting to look at how the power of death influences us as we age. I love that. And I'd love for opportunities for you to be able to share more about that, Rachel. Thank you. When we are free from this power, we can love all things. Yeah, it's interesting how I relate to that. There's, like, this freedom to be able to love and not fear. Exactly, we bore the sense of responsibility, oftentimes to the point of tears and brokenness if people didn't respond to our efforts. Yeah. Yeah, I grieve that with you. Thanks for sharing all that. And I love all of the translation conversations going on as well. That's, like, kind of fun aside. All right, so I want to close us with this prayer, and I pray that it can kind of live with you in this new year, right? Spirit of life, move in us. Expose those motivations of fear and dread. Replace them with resurrection and life. Christ, who has come to save us, we honor you. Amen. Amen. Love you, church. So I hope some of these things can bring some redemptive newness to some of the religious, language and words and things that